This is PGI. Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Genesis Lectures conference call. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, for opening remarks, I'd like to turn the conference over to your moderator today, Dr. Sandy McLeod. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and good morning. Apologies for getting everyone up so early in the morning, and hopefully you can hear me. What I'd like to talk about is fear and anxiety. Could I have the second slide, please? And the points I'd like to make is that fear and anxiety are rather different clinical states with rather different managements. Anxiety is a word that's used rather loosely in modern psychiatry and modern medicine, and there's often a failure, or there's invariably a failure, to differentiate anxiety from fright and fear. I think in palliative care, all our patients are fearful. It's an appalling journey that they have to face. So I would suggest that every patient in palliative care is fearful. Not all patients are anxious, although anxiety is relatively common. We'll talk about that a bit later. Unfortunately, there's no terrifically good modern clinical literature about fear. There's a lot of animal studies talking about fear, but not clinical studies. So my apologies, but I'll have to make some of this talk up as we go. Next slide. These two ladies are important with respect to this talk. The first on the left is Mrs. Pappenheim, who is a patient of Sigmund Freud's with an anxiety disorder. The patient on the right was the lady who was the person who survived the longest, trapped in the Pine Gold Guinness building in the Christchurch earthquake. She was trapped for about 20 hours. I subsequently had the privilege of managing her condition. Her problem was that every time there was an aftershock, she would scream and run outside, which was fairly maladaptive, as it turned out, because she was trying to work, and as you appreciate, for those who lived in Christchurch, we had some pretty awful aftershocks. So it was a very paralyzing condition for her. And the point I'm making is that these two women had really rather different clinical states. To demonstrate this in palliative care terms, a 38-year-old single woman, three young children, carcinoma of the breast, was very worried about what was going to happen if she had a recurrence, what treatment options there were, what side effects from her medications, how her children were going to manage without her in the future, and so forth. She was very anxious. In contrast, a 53-year-old man who had a really nasty oropharyngeal tumour, had surgery, had all the treatment, and a really nasty wound, but he had a terrible inspiratory stridor. He was frightened, he was about to suffocate, and indeed he probably was. He could have bled, he was in pain, he was fearful of what was about to happen in his dying phase. So again, those two patients are very different. I won't go into the history of fear and anxiety much, other than saying that Spinoza, the philosopher, thought that fear was cognitive, very in line with modern cognitive therapy, whereas Pascal thought that fear was emotional. He had the experience of his carriage fell virtually into the Seine River, and he was terrified by this experience and subsequently differentiated between the cognitive theory of fear and what he thought was that fear was an emotion. With respect to anxiety, the Romans always thought that people who were chronically fearful probably had an anxiety condition of some sort, but it wasn't really until the 18th century that firstly the American rush started to differentiate between what was reasonable anxiety, reasonable fears, and unreasonable fears. Unreasonable fears he thought were ghosts, the dark, insects, for example, whereas death he thought was a reasonable fear, as was surgery in those days, which was a very serious option. Viennese Baron, but later further elaborated this, but it was really Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, that introduced to the world the concept of angst or anxiety, which is the English translation of the German word, although it's not a particularly good translation. It was Freud who started to talk about anxiety neuroses. Next slide, please. So there are three human responses to threat or danger: fright, fear and anxiety. Next slide. So fright, and you've all had frights, I'm sure, sudden, unexpected sensory stimulus makes you jump, makes you have reflexive physiological response, often called the startle pattern. And I think we've all had those frights. And on the next slide, this man's about to have similar, a frightful experience, I suspect. There are disorders of fright. Hyperplexia is very rare. That's just sort of genetically acquired propensity to startle easily. Severe post-traumatic stress disorder is probably the best example of fright pathology. Fright's difficult to manage. In fact, it's probably nearly impossible to manage. You can try and prevent it if you know that you're about to experience a fright, but that's sort of very difficult to do. Probably the only respectable way of managing fright is to be intoxicated before you're exposed to the dangerous or frightening situation, but of course that can't always be arranged either. I'm not going to talk more about fright. Fear. And the next slide, a picture of a yacht in somewhat distress, I would suggest. So in fear, there's a specific object of threat. Some fears are innate and some of them are acquired, and we'll talk about that in a moment. And you get a differentiated physiological, behavioural and cognitive response. The behavioural response in fear is very relevant. Fear is a very rational emotion. One has fear. You feel fear. And the symptoms are similar to anxiety, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. But the behavioural reactions are rather different. So the next slide shows a young child who looks as if she's rather fearful. Anxiety, the stimulus is non-specific. It's objectless. People just feel that their self or their existence is somehow threatened. It's said to be maximal at birth and death, although I would argue that. The reaction is very similar, except it's a very irrational response. People know that it's irrational. People know that it's not right. One is anxious. They're fearful that their whole being, their whole self is going to dissolve. And as I say, the symptoms are either a combination of psychological and physiological. And I think we're all aware of those with anxieties about exams, for example, or anxieties about flying or whatever, that one worries, becomes apprehensive, sometimes even panics, and that you have a physiological response, tachycardia, sweating and so forth. So to return to fear for a moment on the next slide, Darwin wrote about this quite a lot. And Darwin's picture of the fearful man. And I think that fear is a universal emotion for the dying. Next slide. And I say this because if you look at all the fear-evoking situations that we can be exposed to, just about all of these occur in palliative care settings. Innate fears in response to pain, being alone, being physically proximate to people, acute bleeding, new places, confined spaces, strange things, all of these things happen in a hospice or an oncology ward. And also people acquire fears of dying and death, fears of being buried alive, fears of needles, fears of hospitals, doctors, even fears of nurses, pretty unusual, but it happens, and fears of flying, for example. So perhaps with the exception of flying, all these fears are experienced by our patients in our hospice. And as I say, the physiological responses to fear are well known. Get butterflies in your stomach, dry mouth and so forth. And that's shown on the next slide, and then on slide 18, the cognitive or psychological fear responses: worry, apprehension, dread, tension. People have catastrophic thoughts. They think that the world is going to end, and indeed it may end if they're in a very dangerous situation. So as I say, the fear responses are realistic. Sometimes people dissociate and almost experience a sense of unreality. It's called derealization. And often people think very slowly in these situations. The behavioural fear responses, you've no doubt all heard of fight and flight responses, which were described during the Great War, actually, about 100 years ago by Cannon. But in animals, and it does occur in people as well, you have freeze responses where people become immobilised. So one of the difficulties with my patient who survived the earthquake, trapped for 20 hours, not able to move, she was just trapped by her little finger, which was trapped under her under her desk. Her behavioural fear response was flight, which is a very appropriate fear response in some situations, but not in an earthquake, where you're meant to stay still for a moment until the rubble has all fallen, and then you're meant to run outside or whatever. Unfortunately, my patient flew before the rubble had finished falling. Well, that's how it appeared to her in the aftershocks anyway. And there is, I've put this, the fourth fear response, behavioural response, which is somewhat new but relatively recently described, the tend and befriend response. And I think we noticed that in the earthquake, that some people in those acute situations are very responsive to the needs of other people. And that's also being considered to be a possible behavioural fear response. Next slide. So some of the classical sort of fears: fear of premature burial, being buried alive. George Washington suffered this, and he left instruction that he wasn't to be buried for several days after his death, for fear that he would be buried alive. It's traditionally a fear for most people. Really, the treatment of that fear was the medicalization of death. One of the few good things that doctors probably brought to palliative care is to accurately diagnose death and certify it so that the person could be buried. Because prior to that in history, family used to make the decision that the person was dead. And this could be very difficult in some situations, particularly some infections such as typhoid, and cholera. It was often very difficult to actually determine if the person was comatosed or dead. So the fear of premature burial still exists, but it's relatively rare. There was an article in one of the palliative care journals in the last 10 years about it, but it's an uncommon fear today. The fear of being dead, thanatophobia, death anxiety, is innately human. It probably peaked in the middle of the 19th century. The authors listed below suggest that it was a byproduct of de-Christianisation, the loss of Christian dogma about heaven and the emergence of secular rationalism. People were frightened that they may be going to hell, not heaven, and therefore that was their fear of being dead. As to what would happen next, that's much less of a fear in modern society, it would seem. However, the fear of dying still exists. Francis Bacon a long time ago said, "I don't believe that any man fears to be dead, but only the stroke of death." In other words, the fear is always, how on earth is one going to die? What's going to happen? And I think all our patients have those thoughts and fears. And I think it's a particularly increasingly modern phenomenon in the elderly, who are prone to being resuscitated by very aggressive modern medicine. And I think that modern medicine's focus on curing and saving life, their focus on the quantity, not the quality of life, is relevant here, and it's obviously something that palliative care tries to address. So the fact that we can actually keep people alive artificially in a way enhances this fear that many old people fear, coming to hospital for fear that they'll end up in an intensive care unit on a respirator and be kept alive well past their biological use by date. So I think the fear of dying, for example, is an increasing fear that we often see. And of course, the fear of cancer recurrence, FRC, it's even got a an acronym now, is said to be quite common. The question is whether this is a fear or an anxiety. And some of it is fear-related, it's realistic-related, and some of it's anxiety-related. And I think it's important to make that differentiation for the management, as I'll talk about a bit later, is somewhat different. The next slide shows some boys who are canoeing. And I guess I'm showing this slide just to demonstrate that everyone reacts to different situations in different ways. It looks as if one of those boys paddling is enjoying the experience, whereas the boy behind them is obviously terrified as they go down the rapids, so that there's a huge variation of human response to situation and fear. And certainly this is very apparent in natural disasters. Some people respond in ways that you wouldn't anticipate, and other people respond in ways that are somewhat surprising. So what's the difference between fear and anxiety? So fear is a reaction to an explicit threatening stimulus. It tends to be very brief. It only lasts for maybe minutes, even seconds, less than an hour mostly. It's present focused, so it concerns what's happening at that particular time. It's reality-based. We'll talk about it can be adaptive and can be maladaptive, whereas anxiety is much less obviously related to a specific stressor or a specific stimulus. And often the cues are non-specific. It's an internal conflict, not an external conflict, so that, as Freud would say, it's to do with your inner psyche, not what's going on in your external world. It's long-lasting. It can be very chronic. We'll talk about that a bit later. And it's future-focused. So people who are anxious are concerned about what's going to happen, whereas people who are fearful are concerned about what is happening at that particular time. Next slide, which is 26. So what are the functions of fear and anxiety? And I think the functions are somewhat different. Fear is designed to enhance safety, which it usually does, although perhaps for my particular patient in the earthquake, her behavioural response to fear was not particularly adaptive, whereas if she was in a bushfire, for example, fleeing from a bushfire would be a very adaptive response, and for those of us who froze in the earthquake, that would be a very dangerous response to have in a bushfire, for example. Fear functions by preparing a person. If you're fearful, as we've noticed in Christchurch, people get organised, get supplies in for the emergency and make sure their phone's charged and they've got batteries and petrol in the car and so forth and so forth. So that's the function of fear. However, if fear is chronic, it can become maladaptive and you can get, I'd say, PTSD-like syndromes, because I'm not sure if you get specific post-traumatic stress disorder, but you get similar symptoms. Whereas anxiety is a bit like inflammation, really. It's designed to try and activate people to get their act together, to start coping, to gain mastery. And in fact, one of the fundamental tenets, I suppose, of Freudian and most psychotherapies is that you need to make the person a little bit anxious so that they start moving ahead with their psychological processing. So good psychotherapy is uncomfortable for the patient, and it should be, because as Freud would say, you need to invoke a degree of anxiety for the process to work. So in some ways, anxiety is rather like acute pain. Interestingly, in significant situations, anxious people don't panic. And I guess in some ways that's rather like stress analgesia. However, if anxiety is chronic, or if it's extraordinarily severe, and when you get bursts of anxiety, that's called panic, it's clearly maladaptive, and it encourages people to, say, avoid going to appointments, not being compliant with your treatment, not agreeing to appropriate treatment, being in denial, or just not being able to sort of process or comprehend what's going on. So in some ways, that's a little bit like chronic pain. So that anxiety and fear have slightly different evolutionary functions. On the next slide, 27, the quote there is from Eric Cassell, who really defines suffering as pretty closely to what the definition of anxiety is. It's a state of severe distress that is subjective and unique to the individual, arising from the perception of threat to one's integrity as a biologic, social or psychological being. So in some ways one could consider the suffering that we see every day in hospice and palliative care is in a way the anxiety of palliative care. The prevalence of suffering, or the prevalence of anxiety, if you like, is probably about 50%, whereas I would say the prevalence of fear is 100%. The prevalence of anxiety in medical settings, that probably refers to fear in medical settings, is less than that, but still quite significant. And the prevalence of anxiety in the general community is probably about 10%. Now, that's somewhat controversial and varies a little bit. Next slide. The causes of anxiety or panic in palliative care. Well, some people are genetically more prone to anxiety than others. Some people, it's the situation that may precipitate it, although there's usually multiple situations. And it's not usually a simple N equals one relationship. So, you know, people worry about what's going to happen, what the next procedure, when the disease is going to relapse, or whether or not their doctor's going to push them out the door or whatever. We certainly see anxiety associated with acute delirium, for example, generalized anxiety disorders. If a person has a pre-existing anxiety condition or a depression, they're much more likely to be anxious. I think we see anxiety associated with pain, although that's probably fair. Steroids, bronchodilators can make people a bit anxious, and sort of drug and alcohol withdrawals, for example. And akathisia I always mention because it's often missed in palliative care, because most of the antiemetics can cause the physiological restlessness of akathisia, which is extraordinarily unpleasant for the patient to feel. But in reality, most of the causes are multifactorial and nothing's as simple as it seems in medicine, as I'm sure you appreciate. So let's move a little bit to the next slide, 29, and talk about fear at the end of life. Well, one of the few studies in this area was conducted by Ivan Lichter in 1990, who suggested that probably less than 10% of deaths in hospices are what he called non-peaceful, which suggests that the vast majority of deaths in hospices are relatively peaceful. And the question is why that is. When I say that 100% of people are fearful, how come 90% can die reasonably comfortably? And I like the expression of Mary Warnock, the British philosopher, talk about easeful deaths. Most people actually have relatively easeful deaths in terminal malignancies. There's a small minority who don't, of course. So on the next slide, this is where this topic becomes difficult, because there's relatively lack of literature about it. So how on earth do we manage fear? Well, the most recognised way of managing fear is behavioural therapy, not cognitive therapy, but I'll come back to that. So that clearly if you can avoid the stimuli, that's helpful. If you can distract yourself from whatever you're fearful of, that can be helpful for a moment. If you have a phobia of needle, for example, you can gradually desensitise that fear. Or sometimes you can flood the fear by just exposing people and they overcome their fear. The reality is that during the passage of during the patient journey, in many ways, many patients are desensitized. They've been perfectly healthy in their life. They suddenly get a diagnosis. They suddenly find themselves not very well in a hospital. They get exposed to all these fearful situations, and sometimes gradually over time they become desensitized to it, or some may just become flooded and begin to settle and not be so fearful of every procedure or event that's going to happen to them. So I think that in a way the process provides behavioural therapy, although sometimes specific behavioural interventions can be helpful. Medications for fear probably don't work. In fact, that's what the literature would say, although recently we've had a patient at Burwood who's had a catatonic state, and that's said to be a freeze response to a fearful situation and responds to high-dose benzodiazepines and ECT, interestingly. But overall, it said that, well, you don't really have time mostly in situations of fear to get the benzodiazepines aboard unless you've had them prophylactically. And one of the major problems we've had in Christchurch after the earthquake is the increasing use of alcohol to prime people, or particularly in the early stages, so that they found that if they were drunk, they were less concerned about the aftershocks. A fairly drastic and dangerous treatment, I might add. The other possible medication treatment for stage fright, for example, is to have beta blockers before you go on stage, and that actually blocks the physiological response of fear, and then that stops the vicious cycle, because when you're sweaty and shaky, that makes you more anxious, so that a vicious cycle is evolved. And beta blockers can sometimes actually prevent that. The more interesting ways of managing fear, which I'll talk about, what I think are probably, they're not purely psychological, they're psychophysiological, they're possibly spiritual actually. So in the next slide, which is 31, I just make the point that, and we've had this discussion a lot in Christchurch, does earthquake-related fear respond to cognitive therapy? Well, it actually doesn't make sense that it would respond, because fear's an innate pre-verbal, pre-emotional reflex response to a recognisable danger. And therefore, despite what Spinoza said, I think Pascal was correct that behavioural therapy cognitive therapy isn't going to work for fear, because fear is actually an emotion, and therefore it's much less responsive to thought manipulations, if you like. So to move on, slide 32, really what the best management of fear is to achieve a state of fearlessness. And the question is, how do our patients achieve a state of fearlessness? Bearing in mind that according to Lecter, 90% of our patients die easeful deaths. How do they achieve that? And I don't know the answer to this, but I think there are various possibilities, and they're listed here on slide 32. Hope's important, and I'll talk about courage and bravery in a moment. So Spinoza defines fear in juxtaposition to hope. So he would say that if you were fearful, fear cannot be without hope, nor hope without fear. In other words, if someone's fearful, there's hope somewhere in that equation, and vice versa. So that, in other words, what Spinoza was suggesting was that if you were hopeful enough, you wouldn't have fear. He defined fear as an uncertain pain arising from the idea that something we hate may befall us, whereas hope's an uncertain pleasure arising from the idea that a good we wish will come to pass. And I think those are very intriguing definitions of fear and hope. On the next slide, so slide 35, so the question is, you know, how do you manipulate hope to abolish someone's fear? And I think the only way you can do that is to, as Spinoza would imply, to provide some degree of certainty. And I think there are two ways of potentially providing certainty. One is emotional palliation. so that we're empathic to our patients who are fearful. We try to reassure them, and we provide protective emotional custody. In other words, what Winnicott and the psychologist would suggest is holding. And I think this is what mothers do to children. Just last week I saw a woman who at the age of 11 survived Cyclone Tracy in Darwin. She and her sister, who was slightly younger, were huddled with their mother in the basement of their house, and the house was just ripped apart by the cyclone. And I said to her, looking back, I don't know, 25 years or however long it was, no more than that, you know, how was it? And she said, well, interestingly, I wasn't scared at the time. She said, but my mother was a very competent person and she knew exactly what to do, and she made us believe that it was okay. So we as children were not frightened, although clearly they could well have died in the cyclone. So that was an example of what I think is protective emotional custody. Mothers are particularly good at doing that with their children. Men not so good, I might say. The other way of manipulating hope is to exploit it, exploit innocent, naive, or unrealistic hopes. And on the next slide, slide 36, I just put this slide to show you the 5-year relative survival rates of various cancers. So that if you're a man and you've got pancreatic cancer, you've got a 3% chance of being alive in 5 years, whereas if you've got testicular cancer, you've got a 95% chance. But in fact, most of our patients, or many of our patients with lung, pancreas, or bad prognostic cancers, hope and presume that they're in the good prognostic. They believe that cancer is going to be cured. They believe what the oncologist may suggest to them on occasions that they're likely to respond. So in a way, that's a manipulation of hope. And I think that the other group that one notices this in is the intellectually disabled, for example, who may not have the cognitive capacity to understand what's going on with them. And they invariably are hopeful that they have a good prognostic cancer. So that we can actually, or the process, or what actually happens in reality is that often people's hopes are falsely manipulated by marginally inaccurate information that's provided by the system. Because actually, if you look at the prognosis of cancer over the last 40 years, the line is slowly upwards for some cancers. One or two exceptions, prostate, this is on slide 37, seems to have made a bit of progress, but most of the other cancers and the slightly orangey-brown line in the middle is of all cancers. So that probably the prognosis of cancer over the last 40 years, the 10-year survival trend has improved by about 10%, which is fantastic but pathetic at the same time. Yet the general public probably believes that the prognosis of cancer in the last 40 years has improved by 50%. I don't know, but in other words, we in medicine tend to talk somewhat hopefully about how effective we are at treating cancer. Next slide. Okay, so that's manipulation of hope. What about acquiring courage? Courage comes from the word heart, core. It's the ability to do something that frightens one. In other words, if you're courageous, despite being terrified, you're able to perform some duty. And Lord Moran, who was Winston Churchill's physician in the Second War, spent most of the First War in the trenches as a medical officer, and he talked very persuasively about how you encourage men to do the impossible, which was to fight the trench war. How do you teach them? How do you persuade them? How do you entice them to overcome the dread malady of fear? And his theory is that you've got to instill courage in men, for example. And I think in many ways that's what we do with our education about death and dying, death talk, so to speak, that we actually try to foster in our patients' courage. We try to suggest to them that actually most people with cancer die relatively peacefully, which is true, and then try to inform them, entice them. I don't know how we do it. And the other question is how effective so-called death talk is. How effective is our education? And I don't know the answer to that, and I leave that to you to think about. The next slide, 39. The problems of teaching courage. I just quote here three great thinkers. Tolstoy, Prince Andrew, who was mortally wounded in battle, asked the question, can this be death? In other words, he was saying, well, how do you as a patient recognize that you're dying? Some people do, some patients don't. When you're in that situation, how do you know that your wound is mortal? So that's one of the problems with teaching courage. Wittgenstein, the philosopher who served in the Great War, in the Austrian army, would say that death's not an event in life. Death isn't something that we can deal with in life because we don't have any experience of it. Although I suppose there are a few people who have been resuscitated these days, but in those days it was pretty unusual. So Wittgenstein saying, look, you can't really talk about death because we don't really have any knowledge about it. So that's one extreme view. Freud, of course, said that every one of us is convinced of our immortality, and that's probably true to some extent as well. So in other words, those three gentlemen would suggest that actually teaching courage with respect to the dying process has its limitations. What about bravery, which I think is a different concept to courage? Brave, endure or face unpleasant conditions or behaviour without showing or feeling any fear. So that brave people do things and it doesn't seem to bother them. They don't seem to be fearful, or they don't seem to be frightened, they just get on and do it. And there are some people who are innately brave, and this is actually very rare. I've spent a lot of my career dealing with police and military, and it's very surprising. You cannot predict who's going to be brave before the event, and even they can't predict. So it's very hard, and this is one of the problems in the military, is to identify people who may be brave in battle, and really no one's ever been able to identify who is likely to be so. So undoubtedly there are a few people in the general community who are just born brave, who don't seem to show any fear or feel any fear. They're a rare event. More commonly, people who acquire bravery through the course of their illness or their circumstances in life, and I think this is very common actually in the dying, and I think this may explain the fact that many people actually die very peaceful or easeful deaths in hospice. They acquire bravery through the process. And the question is how they do that. So I'll give you a couple of examples from history, but I think you all know examples of people who, when you see them, when you first meet them, you think, how on earth are they going to manage this very difficult disease, and how on earth are they going to manage with grace and dignity their death? And yet, lo and behold, they perform marvellously well, really. So here's a quote from Walpole, not the Prime Minister of England, his son. Lovett was beheaded yesterday and died extremely well, without passion, affectation, buffoonery or timidity. His behaviour was natural and intrepid. And I underline intrepid because intrepid, although it's changed its meaning slightly, is really an older fashioned word referring to bravery. And it comes from the Latin intrepidus, lack of alarm. In other words, that intrepid people, they don't show fear, they don't alarm, they don't set off their fear responses. So who was Lovett? Well, actually, Lovett, on the next slide, 42, was really a rat bag. Lord Lovett was the head of the Fraser clan, and he was actually the last man to be beheaded in England. And while he was waiting to be beheaded, a scaffold collapsed, and actually 20 people died, unfortunately, watching him die, who came to watch him die. And this is apparently the expression of laughing your head off. Lovett thought it was hilarious that all these people died coming to watch him die. He was a very unpleasant man. He had a long history of violent feuding, opportunism, deception. He was a liar. He was a rapist, actually. The only good thing that he did in life was that he fought on the correct side of the Battle of Culloden, and that wasn't the English side. So Lovett, but when Lovett was beheaded, he was in his 80s. He'd had a long and undistinguished life and was probably ready to die. So it was relatively easy probably for Lord Lovett to be intrepid. Another example, and actually I was put onto this by the daughter of Richard Byrd, who I happened to meet many years ago. Richard Byrd was an aviator, an American, who flew across the North Pole and then he flew across the South Pole. But in one of his Antarctic expeditions, he was trapped between the South Pole and safety in a small hut, and it was freezing cold, and he had to stay there over winter on his own. And if he turned on his heater, he got intoxicated by the fumes of the heater, and if he turned off his heater, he nearly died of exposure. So this went on for quite a long time. He was turning it off and on, turning it on, and he was terrified. And finally he decided that he was going to die, and from then on he managed his next few months on his own in the middle of the Antarctic very well. In fact, he did a lot of work, he wrote a few books, he had a very creative time. Eventually he was rescued. So in fact, what Byrd suggests in this very good book actually was that if you get to a stage of conceiving no future, you have no hope for the future, you also have no fear, so that you start to live for the day and enjoy what that day can bring. And I think many of our patients and towards the end of their life eventually get to a stage where they suddenly realise that there is actually no future, that they're not going to survive, and then their fear dissipates and I suppose they become brave, really. Of course, one of the difficulties is how do you differentiate no hope from the hopeless, because we know that people who are hopeless are more likely to kill themselves and are obviously very uncomfortable. So people with no hope, and we see this a lot in the hospice, I think, they appreciate the present and the past, for there's no future. Their affect's pretty neutral. They're in survival mode, really, and they're certain as to what's happening. Whereas the hopeless is really an anxiety state. They're worried about the future. They're distressed. And I think that differentiating those two, people who are hopeless are very often depressed, and that needs to be treated separately. So those are some thoughts about the possible management of fear. The management of anxiety is, I think, much better established and known. The management of acute anxiety is rather different to the management of chronic anxiety. The management of acute anxiety is what I would call emotional palliation, reassuring, explaining, holding people. And we know that particularly benzodiazepines are very effective in the acute, an acute panic and acute anxiety, much more effective than any other medications that we have. Probably barbiturates are as effective, and opioids are to some extent effective, but really benzodiazepines are fantastic for acute panic. Whereas the management of chronic anxiety is a combination of psychotherapy, you know, exploring why the person is concerned about what's going to happen in the future, or why they can't stop worrying about what they think might befall them in the future, and pharmacology, and particularly the so-called antidepressants, the SSRIs, are more commonly used these days. And we know that benzodiazepines tend to fade to some extent with chronic anxiety, whereas the so-called antidepressants, which are misnamed really, they're anti-anxiety agents, are much more effective. And this is a graph really to show this really. With respect to anxiety, one of the problems with antidepressants is that, shown in the green line there, is that actually when you introduce antidepressants, anxious people tend to get slightly more anxious for the first couple of days, and then their anxiety fades away. Whereas, as you can see in the really purple line with benzodiazepines, immediately the anxiety starts falling. The black is buspirone, which we don't usually use. I'm never sure how effective it is, but that's rather like the benzodiazepines. So, in my last slide, slide 48, to conclude, the management of so-called anxiety disorders and palliative care, I think we can usually avoid frightening situations for our patients, but a forewarning, preparation. I would say that the disorders of fear are managed rather differently to the disorders of anxiety. Disorders of fear, behavioural therapies are useful, prophylactic intoxicating medications can be used, and I think the psychophysiological spiritual treatments are interesting and seem to work, at least anecdotally. Disorders of anxiety, as I say, psychotherapy and psychoactive medications can be effective. So I will finish at that, and we've probably got about 10 minutes for any questions, comments,